2. Why did the capitalist economy between the wars fail to work? The situation of the USA is a central part of any answer to this question. For if the disruptions of war and post-war Europe, or at least the belligerent countries of Europe, could be made at least partly responsible for the economic troubles there, the USA had been far away from the war, though briefly, if decisively, involved in it. So far from disrupting its economy, the First World War, like the Second World War, benefited it spectacularly. By 1913, the USA had already become the largest economy in the world, producing over one-third of its industrial output, just under the combined total for Germany, Great Britain and France. In 1929, it produced over 42% of the total world output, as against just under 28% for the three European industrial powers. This is a truly astonishing figure. Concretely, while US steel production rose by about one quarter between 1913 and 1920, steel production in the rest of the world fell by about one third. In short, after the end of the First World War, the USA was in many ways as internationally dominant an economy as it once again became after the Second World War. It was the Great Slump which temporarily interrupted this ascendancy. Moreover, the war had not only reinforced its position as the world's greatest industrial producer, but turned it into the world's greatest creditor. The British had lost about a quarter of their global investments during the war, mainly those in the USA, which they had to sell to buy war supplies. The French lost about half of theirs, mainly through revolution and breakdown in Europe. Meanwhile, the Americans, who had begun the war as a debtor country, ended it as the main international lender. Since the USA concentrated its operations in Europe and the Western Hemisphere, the British were still by far the biggest investors in Asia and Africa, their impact on Europe was decisive. In short, there is no explanation of the world economic crisis without the USA. It was, after all, both the premier exporting nation of the world in the 1920s and, after Great Britain, the premier importing nation. As for raw materials and foodstuffs, it imported almost 40% of all the imports of the 15 most commercial nations, a fact which goes a long way to explaining the disastrous impact of the slump on the producers of commodities like wheat, cotton, sugar, rubber, silk, copper, tin, and coffee. By the same token, it was to become the principal victim of the slump. If its imports fell by 70% between 1929 and 1932, its exports fell at the same rate. World trade dipped by less than a third from 1929 to 1939, but US exports crashed by almost half. This is not to underestimate the strictly European roots of trouble, which were largely political in origin. At the Versailles Peace Conference, 1919, vast but undefined payments had been imposed on Germany as reparations for the cost of the war and the damage done to the victorious powers. To justify these, a clause had been inserted into the peace treaty making Germany solely responsible for the war, the so-called War Guilt Clause, which was both historically doubtful and proved to be a gift to German nationalism. The amount Germany was to pay remained vague, as a compromise between the position of the USA, which proposed fixing Germany's payments according to the country's capacity to pay, and the other allies, chiefly the French, who insisted on recovering the entire costs of the war. Their, or at least France's, real object was to keep Germany weak and to have a means of putting pressure on it. In 1921, the sum was fixed at 132 billion 1,000 million gold marks, that is to say $33 billion at the time, which everyone knew to be a fantasy. Reparations led to endless debates, periodic crises and settlements under American auspices, since the USA, to its former allies' displeasure, wished to link the question of Germany's debts to them to that of their own wartime debts to Washington. These were almost as crazy as the sums demanded of the Germans, which amounted to 1.5 times the entire national income of the country in 1929. The British debts to the US amounted to half the British national income, the French debts to two-thirds. A Dawes plan in 1924 actually fixed a real sum for Germany to pay annually. A Young plan in 1929 modified the repayment scheme and, incidentally, set up the Bank of International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland, the first of the international financial institutions which were to multiply after the Second World War. At the time of writing, it is still in business. For practical purposes, all payments, German and Allied, ceased in 1932. Only Finland ever paid its war debts to the USA. Without going into the details, two questions were at issue. First, there was the point made by the young John Maynard Keynes, who wrote a savage critique of the Versailles Conference, in which he took part as a junior member of the British delegation, the economic consequences of the peace, 1920. Without a restoration of the German economy, he argued, the restoration of a stable liberal civilization and economy in Europe would be impossible. The French policy of keeping Germany feeble for the sake of French security was counterproductive. In fact, the French were too weak to impose their policy, even when they briefly occupied the industrial heartland of West Germany in 1923 on the excuse that the Germans were refusing to pay. Eventually, they had to tolerate a policy of German fulfilment after 1924, which strengthened the German economy. But second, there was the question of how reparations were to be paid. Those who wanted to keep Germany weak wanted cash rather than, as was rational, goods out of current production, or at least out of the income from German exports, since this would have strengthened the German economy against its competitors. In effect, they forced Germany into heavy borrowing, so that such reparations as were paid came out of the massive American loans of the mid-1920s. For Germany's rivals, this seemed to have the additional advantage that Germany ran into deep debt rather than expanding its exports to achieve an external balance. In fact, German imports soared. However, the whole arrangement, as we have already seen, made both Germany and Europe highly sensitive to the decline in American lending, which began even before the crisis and the shutting of the American loan tap, which followed the Wall Street crisis of 1929. The entire house of cards of reparations collapsed during the slump. By then, the end of these payments had no positive effects on Germany or the world economy, because this had broken down in an integrated system, and so, in 1931 to 1933, had all arrangements for international payments. However, wartime and post-war disruptions and political complications in Europe can only partly explain the severity of the interwar economic breakdown. Speaking economically, we can look at it in two ways. The first will see chiefly a striking and growing imbalance in the international economy due to the asymmetry in development between the USA and the rest of the world. The world system, it can be argued, did not work because, unlike Great Britain, which had been its centre before 1914, the USA did not much need the rest of the world. And therefore, again, unlike Great Britain, which knew that the world payment system rested on the pound sterling and saw to it that it remained stable, the USA did not bother to act as a global stabiliser. The USA did not need the world much because after the First World War, it needed to import less capital, labour and, relatively speaking, fewer commodities than ever, except for some raw materials. Its exports, though internationally important, Hollywood virtually monopolised the international movie market, made a far smaller contribution to the national income than in any other industrial country. How significant this, as it were, withdrawal of the USA from the world economy was, may be debated. However, it is quite clear that this explanation of the slump was one which influenced US economists and politicians in the 1940s and helped to convince Washington in the war years to take over responsibility for the stability of the world economy after 1945. The second perspective on the Depression fixes on the failure of the world economy to generate enough demand for a lasting expansion. The foundations of the prosperity of the 1920s, as we have seen, were weak, even in the USA, where farming was virtually already in depression, and money wages, contrary to the myth of the Great Jazz Age, were not rising dramatically and actually stagnant in the last mad years of the boom. What was happening, as often happens in free market booms, was that with wages lagging, profits rose disproportionately, and the prosperous got a larger slice of the national cake. But as mass demand could not keep pace with the rapidly increasing productivity of the industrial system in the heyday of Henry Ford, the result was overproduction and speculation. This, in turn, triggered off the collapse. Once again, whatever the arguments among historians and economists who still continue to debate the issue, contemporaries with a strong interest in government policies were deeply impressed with the weakness of demand, not least John Maynard Keynes. When the collapse came, it was, of course, all the more drastic in the USA because, in fact, a lagging expansion of demand had been beefed up by means of an enormous expansion of consumer credit. Readers who remember the later 1980s may find themselves on familiar territory. Banks, already hurt by the speculative real estate boom, which, with the usual help of self-deluding optimists and mushrooming financial crookery, had reached its peak some years before the big crash, loaded with bad debts, refused new housing loans or to refinance existing ones. This did not stop them from failing by the thousands, while in 1933 nearly half of all US home mortgages were in default and 1,000 properties a day were being foreclosed. Automobile purchasers alone owed $1,400 million out of a total personal indebtedness of $6,500 million in short and medium-term loans. What made the economy so much more vulnerable to this credit boom was that customers did not use their loans to buy the traditional mass consumption goods which kept body and soul together and were therefore pretty inelastic, food, clothing and the like. However poor one is, one can't reduce one's demand for groceries below a certain point, and that demand will not double if one's income doubles. Instead, they bought the durable consumer goods of the modern consumer society, which the USA was even then pioneering. But the purchase of cars and houses could be readily postponed, and in any case they had, and have, a very high income elasticity of demand. So unless a slump was expected to be brief or was short, and confidence in the future was not undermined, the effect of such a crisis could be dramatic. Thus, automobile production in the USA halved between 1929 and 1931, or, at a much lower level, the production of poor people's gramophone records, race records, and jazz records addressed to a black public virtually ceased for a while. In short, unlike railroads or more efficient ships or the introduction of steel and machine tools which cut costs, the new products and way of life required high and expanding levels of income and a high degree of confidence about the future to be rapidly diffused. But that is exactly what was collapsing. The worst cyclical slump sooner or later comes to an end, and after 1932 there were increasingly clear signs that the worst was over. Indeed, some economies roared ahead. Japan and, on a more modest scale, Sweden reached almost twice the pre-slump level of production by the end of the 1930s. And by 1938, the German, though not the Italian, economy was 25% above 1929. Even sluggish economies like the British showed plenty of signs of dynamism. Yet somehow the expected upsurge did not return. The world remained in depression. This was most visible in the greatest of all the economies, the USA, for the various experiments in stimulating the economy undertaken under President F.D. Roosevelt's New Deal, sometimes inconsistently, did not really live up to their economic promise. A strong upsurge was followed, in 1937-1938, by another economic crash, though on a rather more modest scale than after 1929. The leading sector of American industry, automobile production, never regained its 1929 peak. In 1938, it was little more than it had been in 1920. Looking back from the 1990s, we are struck by the pessimism of intelligent commentators. Able and brilliant economists saw the future of capitalism left to itself as one of stagnation. This view, anticipated in Keynes's pamphlet against the Versailles Peace Treaty, naturally became popular in the USA after the slump. Must not any mature economy tend to become a stagnating one? As the proponent of another pessimistic prognosis for capitalism, the Austrian economist Schumpeter put it, in any prolonged period of economic malaise, economists, falling in like other people with the humours of their time, proffer theories that pretend to show that depression has come to stay. Perhaps historians looking back on the period from 1973 to the end of the short 20th century from an equal distance will be equally struck by the persistent reluctance of the 1970s and 1980s to envisage the possibility of a general depression of the world capitalist economy. All this in spite of the fact that the 1930s was a decade of considerable technological innovation in industry, for instance, in the development of plastics. Indeed, in one field, entertainment, and what later came to be called the media, the interwar years saw the major breakthrough, at least in the Anglo-Saxon world, with the triumph of mass radio and the Hollywood movie industry, not to mention the modern rotogravura illustrated press. Perhaps it is not quite so surprising that the giant movie theatres rose like dream palaces in the grey cities of mass unemployment, for cinema tickets were remarkably cheap, the youngest as well as the oldest disproportionately hit by unemployment then as later had time to kill, and, as the sociologists observed, during the Depression, husbands and wives were more likely to share joint leisure activities than before. 3. The Great Slump confirmed intellectuals, activists, and ordinary citizens in the belief that something was fundamentally wrong with the world they lived in. Who knew what could be done about it? Certainly few of those in authority over their countries, and certainly not those who tried to steer a course by the traditional navigational instruments of secular liberalism or traditional faith, and by the charts of the 19th century seas, which were plainly no longer to be trusted. How much confidence did economists deserve, however brilliant, who demonstrated with great lucidity that the slump in which even they lived could not happen in a properly conducted free market society, since, according to an economic law named after an early 19th century Frenchman, no overproduction was possible which did not very soon correct itself. In 1933, it was not easy to believe, for instance, that where consumer demand and therefore consumption fell in a depression, the rate of interest would fall by just as much as was needed to stimulate investment, so that the increased investment demand would exactly fill the gap left by the smaller consumer demand. As unemployment soared, it did not seem plausible to believe, as the British Treasury apparently did, that public works would not increase employment at all, because the money spent on them would merely be diverted from the private sector, which would otherwise have generated just as much employment. Economists who simply advised leaving the economy alone, governments whose first instincts, apart from protecting the gold standard by deflationary policies, was to stick to financial orthodoxy, balance budgets and cut costs, were visibly not making the situation better. Indeed, as the Depression continued, it was argued with considerable force, not least by J.M. Keynes, who consequently became the most influential economist of the next 40 years, that they were making the Depression worse. Those of us who lived through the years of the Great Slump still find it almost impossible to understand how the orthodoxies of the pure free market, then so obviously discredited, once again came to preside over a global period of depression in the late 1980s and 1990s, which once again they were equally unable to understand or to deal with. This strange phenomenon should remind us of the major characteristic of history which it exemplifies: the incredible shortness of memory of both the theorists and practitioners of economics. It also provides a vivid illustration of society's need for historians, who are the professional remembrancers of what their fellow citizens wish to forget. In any case, what was a free market economy when an economy increasingly dominated by huge corporations made nonsense of the term perfect competition, and economists critical of Karl Marx could observe that he had been proved right, not least in his prediction of the growing concentration of capital? One did not have to be a Marxist or show an interest in Marx to observe how unlike the economy of 19th century free competition interwar capitalism was. Indeed, well before the Wall Street crash, an intelligent Swiss banker observed that the failure of economic liberalism, and he added pre-1917 socialism, to maintain themselves as universal programs explained the pressure towards autocratic economies, fascist, communist, or under the auspices of large corporations independent of their shareholders. And by the end of the 1930s, the liberal orthodoxies of free market competition were so far away that the world economy could be seen as a triple system composed of a market sector, an intergovernmental sector within which planned or controlled economies such as Japan, Turkey, Germany and the Soviet Union conducted their transactions with each other, and a sector of international public or quasi-public authorities which regulated certain parts of the economy, for example, by international commodity agreements. It is therefore not surprising that the effects of the Great Slump on both politics and public thinking were dramatic and immediate. Unlucky the government which happened to be in office during the cataclysm, whether it was on the right, like Herbert Hoover's presidency in the USA, 1928 to 1932, or on the left, like Britain's and Australia's Labour governments. The change was not always as immediate as in Latin America, where 12 countries changed government or regime in 1930 to 1931, 10 of them by military coup. Nevertheless, by the middle 1930s, there were few states whose politics had not changed very substantially from what they had been before the crash. In Europe and Japan, there was a striking move to the right, except in Scandinavia, where Sweden entered its half-century of social democratic rule in 1932, and in Spain, where the Bourbon monarchy gave way to an unhappy and, as it turned out, short-lived republic in 1931. More of this in the next chapter, though it must be said immediately that the almost simultaneous victory of nationalist, warlike, and actively aggressive regimes in two major military powers, Japan 1931 and Germany 1933, constituted the most far-reaching and sinister political consequence of the Great Depression. The gates to the Second World War were opened in 1931. The strengthening of the radical right was reinforced, at least during the worst period of the slump, by the spectacular setbacks for the revolutionary left. So far from initiating another round of social revolution, as the Communist International had expected, the Depression reduced the international communist movement outside the USSR to a state of unprecedented feebleness. This was admittedly due, in some measure, to the suicidal policy of the Comintern, which not only grossly underestimated the danger of National Socialism in Germany, but pursued a policy of sectarian isolation that seems quite incredible in retrospect, by deciding that its main enemy was the organized mass labor movement of social democratic and labor parties, described as social fascist. Certainly, by 1934, after Hitler had destroyed the German CPD, KPD, once Moscow's hope of world revolution and still by far the largest and apparently most formidable and growing section of the International, when even the Chinese communists expelled from their rural guerrilla bases were no more than a harried caravan on its long march to some distant and safe refuge, very little seemed to be left of a significant organized international revolutionary movement, legal or even illegal. In the Europe of 1934, only the French Communist Party still had a genuine political presence. In fascist Italy, 10 years after the March on Rome and in the depth of the international slump, Mussolini felt sufficiently confident actually to release some imprisoned communists to celebrate that anniversary. All this was to change within a few years, but the fact remains that the immediate result of the slump, at all events in Europe, was the exact opposite of what social revolutionaries had expected. Nor was this decline of the left confined to the communist sector. For with Hitler's victory, the German Social Democratic Party disappeared from sight, while a year later, Austrian social democracy fell after a brief armed resistance. The British Labour Party had already become a victim of the slump, or rather of its belief in 19th century economic orthodoxy in 1931, and its trade unions, which had lost half their members since 1920, were weaker than they had been in 1913. Most of European socialism had its backs to the wall. Outside Europe, however, the situation was different. The northern parts of the Americas moved quite markedly to the left, as the USA, under its new president Franklin D. Roosevelt, 1933 to 1945, experimented with a more radical New Deal, and Mexico, under President Lázaro Cárdenas, 1934 to 1940, revived the original dynamism of the early Mexican Revolution, especially in the matter of agrarian reform. Quite powerful social political movements arose on the crisis-stricken prairies of Canada. Social Credit and the Cooperative Commonwealth Federation, today's new Democratic Party, both on the left by 1930s criteria. It is not so easy to characterize the political impact of the slump on the remainder of Latin America, for if its governments or ruling parties fell like ninepins as the collapse in the world price of their export staples broke their finances, they did not all fall in the same direction. Still, more of them fell towards the left than to the right, even if only briefly. Argentina entered the era of military government after a lengthy period of civilian rule, and though fascist-minded leaders like General Uriburu, 1930 to 1932, were soon sidelined, it clearly moved to the right, even if a traditionalist right. Chile, on the other hand, used the slump to overthrow one of its rare military president dictators before the era of General Pinochet, Carlos Ibáñez, 1927 to 1931, and moved in a stormy fashion towards the left. It actually passed through a momentary socialist republic in 1932 under the splendidly named Colonel Marmaduke Grove, and later developed a successful popular front on the European model. In Brazil, the slump ended the oligarchic Old Republic of 1889 to 1930 and brought to power Getúlio Vargas, best described as a nationalist populist. He dominated his country's history for the next 20 years. The shift in Peru was much more clearly to the left, though the most powerful of the new parties, the American Popular Revolutionary Alliance, APRA, one of the few successful mass working class-based parties of the European type in the Western Hemisphere, failed in its revolutionary ambitions, 1930 to 1932. The change in Colombia was even more clearly to the left. The liberals, under a reform-minded president, much influenced by Roosevelt's New Deal, took over after almost 30 years of conservative rule. The radical shift was even more marked in Cuba, where Roosevelt's inauguration allowed the inhabitants of this offshore US protectorate to overthrow a hated and, even by the then prevailing Cuban standards, unusually corrupt president. In the vast colonial sector of the world, the slump brought a marked increase in anti-imperialist activity, partly because of the collapse of the commodity prices on which colonial economies, or at least their public finances and middle classes, depended, partly because the metropolitan countries themselves rushed to protect their agriculture and employment, irrespective of the effects of such policies on their colonies. In short, European states whose economic decisions were being determined by domestic factors could not in the long term keep together empires with an infinite complexity of producer interests. For this reason, in most of the colonial world, the slump marked the effective beginning of indigenous political and social discontent, which could not but be directed against the colonial government, even where political nationalist movements did not emerge until after the Second World War. In both British West Africa and the Caribbean, social unrest now made its appearance. It grew directly out of the crisis of local export crops, cocoa and sugar. However, even in countries with already developed anti-colonial national movements, the Depression years brought a sharpening of conflict, particularly where political agitation had reached the masses. These, after all, were the years of the expansion of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, founded 1928, and of the second mobilization of the Indian masses by Gandhi, 1931. Perhaps the victory of the Republican ultras under De Valera in the Irish elections of 1932 should also be seen as a belated anti-colonial reaction to the economic breakdown. Probably nothing demonstrates both the globality of the Great Slump and the profundity of its impact more than this rapid bird's-eye view of the virtually universal political upheavals it produced within a period measured in months or single years, from Japan to Ireland, from Sweden to New Zealand, from Argentina to Egypt. Yet the depth of its impact is not to be judged only or even mainly by its short-term political effects, dramatic though these often were. It was a catastrophe which destroyed all hope of restoring the economy and the society of the long 19th century. The period 1929 to 1933 was a canyon which henceforth made a return to 1913 not merely impossible, but unthinkable. Old-fashioned liberalism was dead or seemed doomed. Three options now competed for intellectual political hegemony. Marxist communism was one. After all, Marx's own predictions seemed to be coming true, as the American Economic Association itself was told in 1938, and even more impressively, the USSR appeared to be immune to the catastrophe. A capitalism shorn of its belief in the optimality of free markets and reformed by a sort of unofficial marriage or permanent liaison with the moderate social democracy of non-communist labour movements was the second, and after World War proved to be the most effective. However, in the short run, it was not so much a conscious programme or policy alternative as a sense that once the slump was over, such a thing must never be allowed to happen again, and, in the best of cases, a readiness to experiment stimulated by the evident failure of classical free market liberalism. Thus, the Swedish social democratic policy after 1932 was a conscious reaction to the failures of the economic orthodoxy that had dominated the disastrous British Labour government of 1929 to 1931, at all events in the opinion of one of its major architects, Gunnar Myrdal. An alternative theory to the bankrupt free market economics was only in the process of elaboration. J.M. Keynes's general theory of employment, interest and money, the most influential contribution to it, was not published until 1936. An alternative government practice, the macroeconomic steering and management of the economy based on national income accounting, did not develop until the Second World War and after, though perhaps with an eye on the USSR, governments and other public entities in the 1930s increasingly took to seeing the national economy as a whole and estimating the size of its total product or income. The third option was fascism, which the slump transformed into a world movement and, more to the point, a world danger. Fascism in its German version, National Socialism, benefited both from the German intellectual tradition, which, unlike the Austrian one, had been hostile to the neoclassical theories of economic liberalism that had become the international orthodoxy since the 1880s, and from a ruthless government determined to get rid of unemployment at all costs. It dealt with the Great Slump, it must be said, rapidly and more successfully than any other. The record of Italian fascism was less impressive. However, this was not its major appeal in a Europe that had largely lost its bearings. But as the tide of fascism rose with the Great Slump, it became increasingly clear that in the age of catastrophe, not only peace, social stability and the economy, but also the political institutions and intellectual values of 19th century liberal bourgeois society were in retreat or collapse. To this process, we must now turn. Chapter 4. The Fall of Liberalism. In Nazism, we have a phenomenon which seems scarcely capable of subjection to rational analysis. Under a leader who talked in apocalyptic tones of world power or destruction, and a regime founded on an utterly repulsive ideology of race hatred, one of the most culturally and economically advanced countries of Europe planned for war, launched a world conflagration which killed around 50 million people, and perpetrated atrocities, culminating in the mechanized mass murder of millions of Jews, of a nature and scale as to defy imagination. Faced with Auschwitz, the explanatory powers of the historian seem puny indeed. Ian Kershaw. To die for the fatherland, for the idea. No, that is a cop-out. Even at the front, killing's the thing. Dying is nothing. It's non-existent. Nobody can imagine his own death. Killing's the thing. That's the frontier to be crossed. Yes, that is a concrete act of your will, because there you make your will live in another man's. From the letter of a young volunteer for the Fascist Social Republic of 1943 to 1945. 1. Of all the developments in the age of catastrophe, survivors from the 19th century were perhaps most shocked by the collapse of the values and institutions of the liberal civilization whose progress their century had taken for granted, at any rate in advanced and advancing parts of the world. These values were a distrust of dictatorship and absolute rule, a commitment to constitutional government with or under freely elected governments and representative assemblies, which guaranteed the rule of law, and an accepted set of citizens' rights and liberties, including freedom of speech, publication, and assembly. State and society should be informed by the values of reason, public debate, education, science, and the improvability, though not necessarily the perfectibility, of the human condition. These values, it seemed clear, had made progress throughout the century and were destined to advance further. After all, by 1914, even the two last autocracies of Europe, Russia and Turkey, had made concessions in the direction of constitutional government, and Iran had even borrowed a constitution from Belgium. Before 1914, these values had been challenged only by traditional forces like the Roman Catholic Church, building defensive barricades of dogma against the superior forces of modernity, by a few intellectual rebels and prophets of doom, mainly from good families, and established centres of culture, and thus somehow part of the civilisation they challenged, and the forces of democracy, on the whole a new and troubling phenomenon. The ignorance and backwardness of these masses, their commitment to the overthrow of bourgeois society by social revolution, and the latent human irrationality so easily exploited by demagogues, were indeed a cause for alarm. However, the most immediately dangerous of these new democratic mass movements, the socialist labour movements, were actually, both in theory and in practice, as passionately committed to the values of reason, science, progress, education, and individual freedom as anyone. The German Social Democratic Party's May Day medal showed Karl Marx on one side, the Statue of Liberty on the other. Their challenge was to the economy, not to constitutional government and civility. It would not be easy to regard a government headed by Victor Adler, August Bebel, or Jean Jarre as the end of civilization as we know it. In any case, such government seemed, as yet, remote. Politically, indeed, the institutions of liberal democracy had advanced, and the eruption of barbarism in 1914-1918 had, it seemed, only hastened this advance. Except for Soviet Russia, all the regimes emerging from the First World War, old and new, were basically elected representative parliamentary regimes, even Turkey. Europe, west of the Soviet border, consisted entirely of such states in 1920. Indeed, the basic institution of liberal constitutional government, elections to representative assemblies and or presidents, was almost universal in the world of independent states by this time, although we must remember that the 65 or so independent states of the interwar period were primarily a European and American phenomenon. One-third of the world's population lived under colonial rule. The only states which had no elections whatever in the period 1919 to 1947 were isolated political fossils, namely Ethiopia, Mongolia, Nepal, Saudi Arabia, and Yemen. Another five states had only one election during this period, which does not argue a strong inclination towards liberal democracy, namely Afghanistan, Kuomintang China, Guatemala, Paraguay, and Thailand, then still known as Siam. But the very existence of elections is evidence of at least some penetration of liberal political ideas, at least in theory. One would not, of course, wish to suggest that the mere existence or frequency of elections proves more than this. Neither Iran, which had six elections after 1930, nor Iraq, which had three, could even then count as strongholds of democracy. Still, representative electoral regimes were frequent enough, and yet the 20 years between Mussolini's so-called March on Rome and the peak of the Axis' success in the Second World War saw an accelerating, increasingly catastrophic retreat of liberal political institutions. In 1918 to 1920, legislative assemblies were dissolved or became ineffective in two European states, in the 1920s in six, the 1930s in nine, while German occupation destroyed constitutional power in another five during the Second World War. In short, the only European countries with adequately democratic political institutions that functioned without a break during the entire interwar period were Britain, Finland, only just, the Irish Free State, Sweden, and Switzerland. In the Americas, the other region of independent states, the situation was more mixed, but hardly suggested a general advance of democratic institutions. The list of consistently constitutional and non-authoritarian states in the Western Hemisphere was short. Canada, Colombia, Costa Rica, the USA, and that now forgotten Switzerland of South America and its only real democracy, Uruguay. The best we can say is that the movements between the end of the First World War and that of the Second World War were sometimes to the left as well as to the right. As for the rest of the globe, much of which consisted of colonies and was thus non-liberal by definition, it plainly moved away from liberal constitutions insofar as it ever had them. In Japan, a moderate liberal regime gave way to a nationalist militarist one in 1930-1931. Thailand made some tentative steps towards constitutional government, and Turkey was taken over by the progressive military moderniser Kemal Atatürk in the early 1920s, not a man to let any elections stand in his way. In the three continents of Asia, Africa, and Australasia, only Australia and New Zealand were consistently democratic, for the majority of South Africans remained strictly outside the ambit of the white men's constitution. In short, political liberalism was in full retreat throughout the Age of Catastrophe, a retreat which accelerated sharply after Adolf Hitler became Germany's Chancellor in 1933. Taking the world as a whole, there had been perhaps 35 or more constitutional and elected governments in 1920, depending on where we situate some Latin American republics. Until 1938, there were perhaps 17 such states. In 1944, perhaps 12 out of the global total of 64. The world trend seemed clear. It may be worth reminding ourselves that in this period, the threat to liberal institutions came exclusively from the political right, for between 1945 and 1989, it was assumed, almost as a matter of course, that it came essentially from communism. Until then, the term totalitarianism, originally invented as a description or self-description of Italian fascism, was applied virtually only to such regimes. Soviet Russia, from 1922 the USSR, was isolated and neither able nor, after the rise of Stalin, willing to extend communism. Social revolution under Leninist or any leadership ceased to spread after the initial post-war wave had ebbed. The Marxist social democratic movements had turned into state-sustaining rather than subversive forces, and their commitment to democracy was unquestioned. In most countries' labour movements, communists were minorities, and where they were strong, in most cases they were, or had been, or were about to be, suppressed. The fear of social revolution and the communists' role in it was realistic enough, as the second wave of revolution during and after the Second World War proved, but in the 20 years of liberal retreat, not a single regime that could be reasonably called liberal democratic had been overthrown from the left. The danger came exclusively from the right. And that right represented not merely a threat to constitutional and representative government, but an ideological threat to liberal civilization as such, and a potentially worldwide movement for which the label fascism is both insufficient and not wholly irrelevant. It is insufficient because by no means all the forces overthrowing liberal regimes were fascist. It is relevant because fascism, first in its original Italian form, later in its German form of National Socialism, both inspired other anti-liberal forces, supported them, and lent the international right a sense of historic confidence. In the 1930s, it looked like the wave of the future. As has been said by an expert in the field, it is no accident that the Eastern European royal dictators, bureaucrats and officers, and Franco in Spain should have mimicked fascism. The forces overthrowing liberal democratic regimes were of three kinds, omitting the more traditional form of military coups installing Latin American dictators or caudillos, which had no particular political colouring a priori. All were against social revolution, and indeed a reaction against the subversion of the old social order in 1917 to 1920 was at the root of all of them. All were authoritarian and hostile to liberal political institutions, though sometimes for pragmatic reasons rather than on principle. Old-fashioned reactionaries might ban some parties, notably the communist, but not all. After the overthrow of the short-lived Hungarian Soviet Republic of 1919, Admiral Horthy, head of what he maintained was the Kingdom of Hungary, though it no longer had either king or navy, governed an authoritarian state which remained parliamentary but not democratic, in the old 18th-century oligarchic sense. All tended to favour the military and foster the police or other bodies of men capable of exercising physical coercion, since these were the most immediate bulwarks against subversion. Indeed, their support was often essential for the right to come to power, and all tended to be nationalist, partly because of resentment against foreign states, lost wars, or insufficient empires, partly because waving national flags was a way to both legitimacy and popularity. Nevertheless, there were differences. Old-fashioned authoritarians or conservatives, Admiral Horthy, Marshal Mannerheim of Finland, winner of the civil war of white versus red in newly independent Finland, Colonel, later Marshal Pilsudski, the liberator of Poland, King Alexander, formerly of Serbia, now of the newly united Yugoslavia, and General Francisco Franco of Spain, had no particular ideological agenda other than anti-communism and the prejudices traditional to their class. They might find themselves allied to Hitler, Germany, and to fascist movements in their own countries, but only because in the interwar conjuncture, the natural alliance was one of all sectors of the political right. Of course, national considerations might cut across this alliance. Winston Churchill, a strongly right-wing Tory in this period, though an uncharacteristic one, expressed some sympathy for Mussolini's Italy and could not bring himself to support the Spanish Republic against General Franco's forces, but Germany's threat to Britain made him into the champion of international anti-fascist union. On the other hand, such old reactionaries might also have to confront the opposition of genuinely fascist movements in their own countries, sometimes with substantial mass support. A second strand of the right produced what has been called organic statism, or conservative regimes not so much defending a traditional order, but deliberately recreating its principles as a way of resisting both liberal individualism and the challenge of labour and socialism. Behind it stood an ideological nostalgia for an imagined Middle Ages or feudal society in which the existence of classes or economic groups was recognised, but the awful prospect of class struggle was kept at bay by the willing acceptance of social hierarchy, by a recognition that each social group or estate had its part to play in an organic society composed of all and should be recognised as a collective entity. This produced various brands of corporativist theories, which replaced liberal democracy by the representation of economic and occupational interest groups. This was sometimes described as organic participation or democracy, and therefore better than the real kind, but in fact was invariably combined with authoritarian regimes and strong states ruled from above, largely by bureaucrats and technocrats. It invariably limited or abolished electoral democracy. Democracy based on corporative correctives, in the phrase of the Hungarian premier Count Bethlen. The most complete examples of such corporate states were found in some Roman Catholic countries, notably the Portugal of Professor Oliveira Salazar, the longest-lived of all Europe's anti-liberal regimes of the right, 1927 to 1974, but also in Austria between the destruction of democracy and the invasion of Hitler, 1934 to 1938, and to some extent in Franco's Spain. Yet if reactionary regimes of this kind had origins and inspirations both older than fascism and sometimes very different from it, no clear line separated the two because both shared the same enemies, if not the same goals. Thus the Roman Catholic Church, profoundly and unswervingly reactionary as it was in the version officially consecrated by the First Vatican Council of 1870, was not fascist. Indeed, by its hostility to essentially secular states with totalitarian pretensions, it had to be opposed to fascism. Yet the doctrine of the corporate state, most fully exemplified in Catholic countries, had been largely elaborated in Italian fascist circles, though these, of course, drew on the Catholic tradition among others. Indeed, these regimes were sometimes actually called clerical fascist. Fascists in Catholic countries might emerge directly out of integrist Catholicism, as in the Rexist movement of the Belgian Léon de Grelle. The ambiguity of the Church's attitude to Hitler's racism has often been noted. Less often, the considerable help given after the war by persons within the Church, sometimes in important positions, to fugitive Nazis or fascists of various kinds, including many accused of horrifying war crimes. What linked the Church not only with old-fashioned reactionaries but with fascists was a common hatred for the 18th-century Enlightenment, the French Revolution, and all that in the Church's opinion derived from it: democracy, liberalism, and, of course, most urgently, godless communism. In fact, the fascist era marked a turning point in Catholic history, largely because the Church's identification with a right whose major international standard-bearers were now Hitler and Mussolini created substantial moral problems for socially-minded Catholics, not to mention, as fascism retreated towards inevitable defeat, substantial political problems for insufficiently anti-fascist hierarchies. Conversely, anti-fascism, or just patriotic resistance to the foreign conqueror, for the first time gave democratic Catholicism, Christian democracy, legitimacy within the Church. Political parties mobilizing the Roman Catholic vote had come into existence on pragmatic grounds in countries where Catholics were a significant minority, normally to defend Church interests against secular states, as in Germany and the Netherlands. The Church resisted such concessions to the politics of democracy and liberalism in officially Catholic countries, although it was sufficiently worried by the rise of godless socialism to formulate, a radical innovation, a social policy in 1891 which stressed the need to give workers their due while maintaining the sacredness of family and private property, but not of capitalism as such. This had proved a first foothold for social Catholics or others prepared to organise such forms of worker defence as Catholic labour unions, also more inclined by such activities to the more liberal side of Catholicism. Except in Italy, where Pope Benedict XV, 1914 to 1922, briefly permitted a large Catholic popular party to emerge after the First World War until fascism destroyed it, democratic and social Catholics remained politically marginal minorities. It was the advance of fascism in the 1930s which brought them into the open, even though the Catholics who declared their support for the Spanish Republic were a small, if intellectually distinguished, band. The support of Catholics went overwhelmingly to Franco. It was the resistance, which they could justify on grounds of patriotism rather than the ideology, which gave them their chance, and victory which allowed them to take it. But the triumphs of political Christian democracy in Europe and some decades later in parts of Latin America belonged to a later period. In the period when liberalism fell, the Church, with rare exceptions, rejoiced at its fall. 2. There remained the movements which can be truly called fascist. The first of these was the Italian one which gave the phenomenon its name, the creation of a renegade socialist journalist, Benito Mussolini, whose first name, a tribute to the Mexican anti-clerical president Benito Juarez, symbolized the passionate anti-papalism of his native Romania. Adolf Hitler himself acknowledged his debt to and respect for Mussolini, even when both Mussolini and fascist Italy had demonstrated their feebleness and incompetence in the Second World War. In return, Mussolini took over from Hitler, rather late in the day, the anti-Semitism which had been totally absent from his movement before 1938, and indeed from the history of Italy since its unification. However, Italian fascism alone did not exercise much international attraction, even though it tried to inspire and finance similar movements elsewhere and showed some influence in unexpected quarters, as on Vladimir Jabotinsky, the founder of Zionist revisionism, which became the government of Israel under Menachem Begin in the 1970s. Without the triumph of Hitler in Germany in early 1933, fascism would not have become a general movement. In fact, all the fascist movements outside Italy that amounted to anything were founded after his arrival in power, notably the Hungarian Arrow Cross, which scored 25% of votes in the first secret ballot ever held in Hungary, 1939, and the Romanian Iron Guard, whose real support was even greater. Indeed, even movements virtually financed entirely by Mussolini, like the Croatian Ustashi terrorists of Ante Pavelic, did not gain much ground and became ideologically fascicized until the 1930s, when part of them also looked for inspiration and finance to Germany. More than this, without Hitler's triumph in Germany, the idea of fascism as a universal movement, a sort of right-wing equivalent of international communism, with Berlin as its Moscow, would not have developed. This did not produce a serious movement, but only, during the Second World War, ideologically motivated collaborators with the Germans in occupied Europe. It was on this point that, notably in France, many on the traditional ultra-right, however savagely reactionary, refused to follow. They were nationalists, or they were nothing. Some even joined the resistance. Moreover, without the international standing of Germany as an evidently successful and rising world power, fascism would have had no serious impact outside Europe, nor indeed would non-fascist reactionary rulers have bothered to dress up as fascist sympathizers, as when Portugal's Salazar claimed in 1940 that he and Hitler were linked by the same ideology. What the various brands of fascism had in common, other than, after 1933, a general sense of Germany hegemony, is not so easy to discern. Theory was not the strong point of movements devoted to the inadequacies of reason and rationalism and the superiority of instinct and will. They attracted all kinds of reactionary theorists in countries with an active conservative intellectual life. Germany is an obvious case in point. But these were decorative rather than structural elements of fascism. Mussolini could have readily dispensed with his house philosopher Giovanni Gentile, and Hitler probably neither knew nor cared about the support of the philosopher Heidegger. Fascism cannot be identified either with a particular form of state organization, such as the corporate state. Nazi Germany lost interest in such ideas rapidly, all the more since they conflicted with the idea of a single undivided and total Volksgemeinschaft, or people's community. Even so apparently central an element as racism was initially absent from Italian fascism. Conversely, of course, as we have seen, fascism shared nationalism, anti-communism, anti-liberalism, and so on with other non-fascist elements on the right. Several of these, notably among the non-fascist French reactionary groups, also shared with it a preference for politics as street violence. The major difference between the fascist and the non-fascist right was that fascism existed by mobilizing masses from below. It belonged essentially to the era of democratic and popular politics, which traditional reactionaries deplored and which the champions of the organic state tried to bypass. Fascism gloried in the mobilization of masses and maintained it symbolically in the form of public theatre, the Nuremberg rallies, the masses on the Piazza Venezia looking up to Mussolini's gestures on his balcony, even when it came to power, as also did communist movements. Fascists were the revolutionaries of counter-revolution. In their rhetoric, in their appeal to those who considered themselves victims of society, in their call for a total transformation of society, even in their deliberate adaptation of the symbols and names of the social revolutionaries, which is so obvious in Hitler's National Socialist Workers' Party, with its modified red flag and its immediate institution of the Reds' 1st of May as an official holiday in 1933. Similarly, though fascism also specialized in the rhetoric of return to the traditional past and received much support from classes of people who would genuinely have preferred to wipe out the past century if they could, it was in no real sense a traditionalist movement like, say, the Carlists of Novara, who formed one of the main bodies of Franco's support in the Civil War, or Gandhi's campaigns for a return to handlooms and village ideals. It stressed many traditional values, which is another matter. They denounced liberal emancipation, women should stay at home and bear a great many children, and they distrusted the corroding influence of modern culture, and especially of the modernist arts, which the German National Socialists described as cultural Bolshevism and degenerate. Yet the central fascist movements, the Italian and the German, did not appeal to those historic guardians of the conservative order, church and king, but on the contrary sought to supplant them by an entirely non-traditional leadership principle embodied in self-made men legitimized by their mass support and by secular ideologies and sometimes cults. The past to which they appealed was an artifact. Their traditions were invented. Even Hitler's racism was not the pride in an unbroken and unmixed line of kinship descent which provides genealogists with commissions from Americans who hope to prove their descent from some 16th-century Suffolk yeoman, but a late 19th-century post-Darwinian farrago claiming, and alas, in Germany often receiving, the support of the new science of genetics, or more precisely of that branch of applied genetics, eugenics, which dreamed of creating a human super-race by selective breeding and the elimination of the unfit. The race destined through Hitler to dominate the world did not even have a name until 1898, when an anthropologist coined the term Nordic. Hostile as it was on principle to the heritage of the 18th century Enlightenment and the French Revolution, fascism could not formally believe in modernity and progress, but it had no difficulty in combining a lunatic set of beliefs with technological modernity in practical matters, except where it crippled its basic scientific research on ideological grounds. Fascism was triumphantly anti-liberal. It also provided the proof that men can, without difficulty, combine crack-brained beliefs about the world with a confident mastery of contemporary high technology. The late 20th century, with its fundamentalist sects, wielding the weapons of television and computer-programmed fundraising, have made us more familiar with this phenomenon. Nevertheless, the combination of conservative values, the techniques of mass democracy, and an innovative ideology of irrationalist savagery, essentially centered in nationalism, must be explained. Such non-traditional movements of the radical right had emerged in several European countries in the late 19th century in reaction against both liberalism, that is to say, the accelerating transformation of societies by capitalism, and the rising socialist working class movements, and more generally against the tide of foreigners that was sweeping across the world in the greatest mass migration of history up to that date. Men and women migrated not only across oceans and international frontiers, but from country to city, from one region of the same state to another, in short, from home to the land of strangers, and turning the coin round as strangers into others' home. Almost 15 out of every 100 Poles left their country for good, plus 500,000 a year as seasonal migrants, overwhelmingly, as such migrants did, to join the working classes of the receiving countries. Anticipating the late 20th century, the late 19th pioneered mass xenophobia, of which racism, the protection of the pure native stock against contamination or even submersion by the invading subhuman hordes, became the common expression. Its strength can be measured not only by the fear of Polish immigration, which led the great German liberal sociologist Max Weber into temporary support for the Pangerman League, but by the increasingly febrile campaign against mass immigration in the USA, which eventually, during and after the First World War, led the country of the Statue of Liberty to bar its frontiers to those whom the statue had been erected to welcome. The common cement of these movements was the resentment of little men in a society that crushed them between the rock of big business on one side and the hard place of rising mass labour movements on the other, or which, at the very least, deprived them of the respectable position they had occupied in the social order and believed to be their due, or the social status in a dynamic society to which they felt they had a right to aspire. These sentiments found their characteristic expression in anti-Semitism, which began to develop specific political movements based on hostility to the Jews in the last quarter of the 19th century in several countries. Jews were almost universally present and could readily symbolize all that was most hateful about an unfair world, not least its commitment to the ideas of the Enlightenment and the French Revolution, which had emancipated them and, in doing so, had made them so much more visible. They could serve as symbols of the hated capitalist financier, of the revolutionary agitator, of the corroding influence of rootless intellectuals and the new mass media, of the competition, how could it be otherwise than unfair, that gave them a disproportionate share of jobs in certain professions requiring education, and of the foreigner and outsider as such. Not to mention the accepted view among old-fashioned Christians that they had killed Jesus Christ. Dislike of Jews was indeed pervasive in the Western world, and their position in 19th-century society was indeed ambiguous. Yet the fact that striking workers were apt, even when members of non-racist labour movements, to attack Jewish shopkeepers and to think of their employers as Jews, often enough correctly in large zones of Central and Eastern Europe, should not lead us into seeing them as proto-national socialists, any more than the matter-of-course anti-Semitism of Edwardian British liberal intellectuals, such as the Bloomsbury Group, made them into sympathisers of political anti-Semites of the radical right. The peasant anti-Semitism of East Central Europe, where for practical purposes the Jew was the point of contact between the livelihood of the villager and the outside economy on which it depended, was certainly more permanent and explosive, and became more so as Slav, Magyar or Romanian rural societies became increasingly convulsed by the incomprehensible earthquakes of the modern world. Among such dark people, tales of Jews sacrificing Christian children could still be believed, and moments of social explosion would lead to pogroms, which reactionaries in the Tsar's empire encouraged, especially after the assassination of Tsar Alexander II in 1881 by social revolutionaries. Here a straight road leads from original grassroots anti-Semitism to the extermination of Jewry during the Second World War. Certainly, grassroots anti-Semitism gave such East European fascist movements as acquired a mass base, notably the Romanian Iron Guard and the Hungarian Arrow Cross, their foundation. At all events, in the former territories of Habsburg and Romanov, this connection was much clearer than in the German Reich, where grassroots, rural and provincial anti-Semitism, though strong and deeply rooted, was also less violent, one might even say more tolerant. Jews who escaped from newly occupied Vienna to Berlin in 1938 were astonished at the absence of street anti-Semitism. Here, violence came by decree from above, as in November 1938. Yet even so, there is no comparison between the casual and intermittent savagery of the pogroms and what was to come a generation later. The handful of dead of 1881, the 40 to 50 of the Kishinev pogrom of 1903, outraged the world, and justifiably, because in the days before the advance of barbarism, such a number of victims seemed intolerable to a world which expected civilization to advance. Even the much larger pogroms that accompanied the mass peasant risings of the 1905 Russian Revolution had, by later standards, only modest casualties, perhaps 800 dead in all. This may be compared to the 3,800 Jews killed in Vilna, by the Lithuanians in 3 days of 1941 as the Germans invaded the USSR and before the systematic exterminations got underway. The new movements of the radical right, which appealed to but fundamentally transformed these older traditions of intolerance, appealed particularly to the lower and middle groups of European societies and were formulated as rhetoric and theory by nationalist intellectuals who emerged as a trend in the 1890s. The very term nationalism was coined in that decade to describe these new spokesmen of reaction. Middle and lower middle class militancy took a turn to the radical right, chiefly in countries where the ideologies of democracy and liberalism were not dominant, or among classes which did not identify with them, that is to say, chiefly in countries which had not undergone a French Revolution or its equivalent. Indeed, in the core countries of Western liberalism, Britain, France, and the USA, the general hegemony of the revolutionary tradition prevented the emergence of any mass fascist movements of importance. It is a mistake to confuse the racism of American populists or the chauvinism of French republicans with proto-fascism. These were movements of the left. This did not mean that, once the hegemony of liberty, equality, and fraternity no longer stood in the way, old instincts might not attach themselves to new political slogans. There is little doubt that the activists of the swastika in the Austrian Alps were to be largely recruited from the sort of provincial professionals, veterinary surgeons, surveyors, and the like, who had once been the local liberals, an educated and emancipated minority in an environment dominated by peasant clericalism. Just so, in the later 20th century, the disintegration of the classical proletarian labour and socialist movements left the instinctive chauvinism and racism of so many manual workers free play. Hitherto, while far from immune to such sentiments, they had hesitated to express them in public out of loyalty to parties passionately hostile to such bigotry. Since the 1960s, Western xenophobia and political racism is found mainly among the manual labouring strata. However, in the decades when fascism was incubated, it belonged to those who did not get their hands dirty at work. The middle and lower middle strata remained the backbone of such movements throughout the era of the rise of fascism. This is not seriously denied, even by historians anxious to revise the consensus of virtually every analysis of Nazi support produced between 1930 and 1980. To take merely one case among the many inquiries into the membership and support of such movements into war Austria. Of the National Socialists elected as direct councillors in Vienna in 1932, 18% were self-employed, 56% were white-collar office workers and public employees, and 14% were blue-collar. Of the Nazis elected in five Austrian assemblies outside Vienna in the same year, 16% were self-employed and farmers, 51% were office workers, for example, and 10% were blue collars. This does not mean that fascist movements could not acquire genuine mass support among the labouring poor. Whatever the composition of its cadres, the Romanian Iron Guard's support came from the poor peasantry. The Hungarian Arrow Cross electorate was largely working class, the Communist Party being illegal and the Social Democratic Party, always small, paying the price for its toleration by the Horthy regime. And after the defeat of Austrian social democracy in 1934, there was a noticeable swing of workers to the Nazi Party, especially in the Austrian provinces. Moreover, once fascist governments with public legitimacy had established themselves, as in Italy and Germany, far more formally socialist and communist workers than the left tradition likes to dwell on fell into line with the new regimes. Nevertheless, since fascist movements had trouble in appealing to the genuinely traditional elements in rural society, unless reinforced, as in Croatia, by organisations like the Roman Catholic Church, and were the sworn enemies of the ideologies and parties identified with the organised working classes, their core constituency was naturally to be found in the middle strata of society. How far into the middle class the original appeal of fascism extended is a more open question. Certainly its appeal to middle-class youth was strong, especially to continental European university students, who, between the wars, were notoriously on the ultra-right. 13% of the members of the Italian fascist movement of 1921, that is to say, before the March on Rome, were students. In Germany, between 5% and 10% of all students were party members as early as 1930, when the great majority of future Nazis had not begun to take an interest in Hitler. As we shall see, the element of middle-class ex-officers was strongly represented, the sort for whom the Great War, with all its horrors, marked a mountain peak of personal achievement, from which the view showed only the disappointing lowlands of their future civilian life. These were, of course, segments of the middle strata particularly receptive to the appeals of activism. Broadly speaking, the appeal of the radical right was the stronger, the greater the threat to the standing, actual or conventionally expected, of a middle-class occupation, as the framework buckled and broke that was supposed to hold their social order in place. In Germany, the double blow of the great inflation, which reduced the value of money to zero, and the subsequent great slump radicalized even strata of the middle class, such as middle and higher civil servants, whose position seemed secure, and who would, under less traumatic circumstances, have been happy to continue as old-style conservative patriots, nostalgic for Kaiser William, but willing to do their duty to a republic headed by Field Marshal Hindenburg, had it not been visibly collapsing under their feet. Most non-political Germans between the wars looked back to William's empire. As late as the 1960s, when most West Germans had understandably concluded that the best times in German history were now, 42% of those over 60 years old still thought that the time before 1914 was better than the present, as against 32% who were converted by the Wirtschaftswunder. The voters of the bourgeois centre and right defected in massive numbers to the Nazi Party between 1930 and 1932, yet these were not the builders of fascism. Such conservative middle classes were, of course, potential supporters or even converts to fascism, because of the way the interwar lines of political battle were drawn. The threat to liberal society and all its values seemed to come exclusively from the right, the threat to the social order from the left. Middle-class people chose their politics according to their fears. Traditional conservatives usually sympathized with the demagogues of fascism and were prepared to ally with them against the major enemy. Italian fascism had a rather good press in the 1920s and even in the 1930s, except from liberalism leftwards. But for the bold experiment of fascism, the decade has not been fruitful in constructive statesmanship, wrote John Buchan, the eminent British conservative and thriller writer. A taste for writing thrillers has, alas, rarely gone with left-wing convictions. Hitler was brought to power by a coalition of the traditional right, which he subsequently swallowed. General Franco included the then not very significant Spanish Falange in his National Front because what he represented was the union of the entire right against the spectres of 1789 and 1917, between which he did not make fine distinctions. He was lucky enough not actually to join in the Second World War on Hitler's side, but he sent a volunteer force, the Blue Division, to fight the godless communists in Russia side by side with the Germans. Marshal Pétain was certainly not a fascist or Nazi sympathizer. One reason why it was so difficult after the war to distinguish between wholehearted French fascists and pro-German collaborators on one hand and the main body of support for Marshal Pétain's Vichy regime on the other was that there was in fact no clear line. Those whose fathers had hated Dreyfus, the Jews, and the Bitch Republic, some Vichy figures were old enough to have done so themselves, shaded insensibly into the zealots for a Hitlerian Europe. In short, the natural alliance of the right between the wars went from traditional conservatives via old-style reactionaries to the outer fringes of fascist pathology. The traditional forces of conservatism and counter-revolution were strong, but often inert. Fascism provided them both with a dynamic and, perhaps even more important, with the example of victory over the forces of disorder. Was not the proverbial argument in favour of fascist Italy that Mussolini made the trains run on time? Just as the dynamism of the communists exercised an attraction on the disoriented and rudderless left after 1933, so the successes of fascism, especially after the National Socialist takeover in Germany, made it look like the wave of the future. The very fact that at this time fascism made a prominent, if brief, entrance on, of all countries, the political scene of conservative Great Britain demonstrates the power of this demonstration effect. That it converted one of the most prominent of the nation's politicians and won the support of one of its major press lords is more significant than the fact that Sir Oswald Mosley's movement was quickly abandoned by respectable politicians and Lord Rothermere's Daily Mail soon dropped its support of the British Union of Fascists. For Britain was still universally and rightly seen as a model of political and social stability.